Thank you, Brother Ben Van Duzer. Appreciate the invitation to be back with you folks. We've looked forward to it for a long time. We really, my wife and I, travel around in this work that God has allowed us to have. So we really don't have a church home, a church at large is our home, as it were. But the last time we were here, we were so blessed. I have to confess, I was looking forward to meeting with you tomorrow, especially during the remembrance time. I just look forward to it. So I'm going to pray that God lifts us up like he did last time. We want to talk today about how to share your faith. How to share your faith. How to prepare especially young people to do that. And I was asking Brother Van Duzer how to do this, what kind of information is helpful most to young people and family people. And he suggested that one of the areas where people have so many questions and need the help is in the area of dinosaurs. So we thought we'd talk a little bit about that today. And so some of the evidence for creation would be this session that we're having here. Then in the next session, I'd like to discuss with you Genesis and geology. There is a lot of information here that's especially helpful for people who are talking with those who are interested in the sciences, and it just confirms the scripture and gives us real confidence that his word is correct. Tomorrow morning, God willing, we would like to talk about the puzzle of ancient man. As you know, there are two views about where man has come from. One is that we've come up from the animal, and if that view were correct, then the further we went into the past, the more primitive ought man to be. But what does science show us? Science shows us the further we go into the past, the higher was the level of science and technology. They had computers thousands of years ago, and I'll show you a picture of one. How do you put those together with the idea that man has come up from the animal? Then in our last session tomorrow afternoon, I would like to share with you at least seven very, very exciting areas. Your news media doesn't tell you this, but science, as we have it today, modern science, came out of the Dark Ages when people began to read the scriptures. And that's why historians, even atheist historians, tell us that modern science traces its roots to biblical creation. Well, that's still true today. Who are the scientists making leading discoveries? I mean, really important, major discoveries. It is people who believe the scriptures, creationists, as we are called. And I'll show you some of those exciting new areas. I mean, really exciting. Like, for example, you say, like what? Well, not only can we explain the features of Earth history, but as in the past, scientists who believe the Bible made discoveries that were very beneficial to man. For example, Louis Pasteur, of course, you know, discovered vaccination. He had the patent on it even. He refused to take any money for it because he said, God gave that to me to serve my fellow man. Well, what's happening today? I was just talking with a group here in the west of us in Cincinnati. By God's grace, they have found a way to completely neutralize atomic wastes and get useful products out of it in the process. And I'll be sharing a little bit some of these things, biblical creation and the scientific evidence. And our people need to know that. I was invited to a public high school teacher's in-service training here 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, I guess it is. And these teachers, the superintendent of the district, the curriculum directors, and the teachers were there. And I presented what creationists are doing, and their mouth dropped about a foot. And I asked the teachers afterwards, one of the teachers, I think, was a Christian fellow, I'm not sure, a young teacher. I said, what was the impression of the teachers when we talked about these things that creationists are doing because they're creationists, not because we're just scientists, but because we trust the scriptures? And the teacher said to me, I have never seen these teachers ask so few questions. They were afraid to ask questions because they didn't want to look ignorant. And so we're hoping for further opportunities. So these are the four sessions, evidence for creation, a little bit about dinosaurs and some fossils in this session. Then in the following session, Genesis and geology. Tomorrow morning, ancient man. And then tomorrow afternoon, some of the new developments. Thank you, brother, for trying. Appreciate that. Thank you very much. So these are the topics that we would like to cover. Now, our title then for this, and why would we do these kinds of things? Why would we take time to discuss this? Because the scriptures tell us in 1 Peter 3:15, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and be ready always to give an answer to every man who asks you a reason for the hope that you have within you with meekness and fear. We believe by faith, but it's not a blind faith. And if I hear this scripture right, if somebody comes up to me and says, why do you believe this? I have a responsibility to give him some reasons. We were standing in an airport getting ready to go to one of our speaking assignments, and there was a young man there waiting in line for the airplane door to open so we could go on down the walkway there. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm going to give some lectures. What are you lecturing on? Scientific evidence that the Bible is correct. And this guy was so fascinated. He'd never heard such an idea. And he says, how do you know? And all he was just totally engrossed. He didn't care around who was listening or anything else. We have to be ready to give some answers to people who ask us questions. And so if they have questions in some area of science, or they'll ask about dinosaurs, if these are hurdles, almost every time we discuss this, people bring that up. It's been brought up twice while we've been here this weekend. If these are hurdles over which they have to pass in coming to faith, then we ought to care enough to learn some answers to help them over those hurdles. And you don't have to be a scientist to know those answers. All you have to do is know where the answers are. You don't have to be a scientist to know these answers to the questions that people are asking, for the same reason you don't have to be a mechanic to drive a car. Why don't you have to be a mechanic to drive a car? Because if something goes wrong with your car, then you know where there's a mechanic or something, someone can have the knowledge to fix it. Well, there is free literature out. There are radio programs. There are speakers. There are books like we have at the back. There are videotapes and so on that are available. And you can know where those are. For example, one of the books back there is kind of interesting. One of the books back there on the table is called The Answers Book. There are only about 12 questions that people ask over and over and over and over again. You learn those 12 answers, and they think you come from Mars. I mean, you're the smartest man and woman they ever met. Where did Cain get his wife? That's one of the common questions. Do you know? I had a guy ask me that this week. Were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? What about carbon dating? Where'd the races come from? These are questions that are handled in that little book. And so all we have to do is learn the answers, how to do that. So our seminar objectives that my wife and I give as we travel around have two. We have two objectives in our seminars. Number one is helping people discover that the Creator cares. I love the logic of the Bible. Romans 10:13-14. For whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Notice the next verse. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe on him in whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? The overwhelming vast majority of educated people have not heard the things we're going to be talking about in our seminar here this series. And the second one is to support our faith, Hebrews 11:1. This is the one place in the Bible where Christian faith is defined, Hebrews 11:1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. You can't see electricity, can't hear electricity, can't taste electricity, but you know it's there. You can't see the Creator, you can't hear the Creator, can't taste the Creator, but there's more evidence that He's there than there is that is electricity. So we have these two goals, helping people discover that the Creator cares, number one, and number two, helping us have a foundation for our faith. Now, as students go to public schools, but it's all in our culture around. I don't care even if it's a Christian school. Brother Van Duzer and I have been talking about some of these things. Our culture influences not only ourselves, but our young people as well. So our young people face a dilemma. What is the problem faced by our young people? Number one, there's a tremendous bias in our culture, in the news media, and in schools and in textbooks, the bias is naturalism. And as you know, that's the idea that you can explain everything without a creator. That's the concept. Secondly, there's a lot of ignorance out there. People out there, frankly, and I don't mean to be unkind, are ignorant. I've been invited to universities, science groups. People say, well, how do scientists react to your idea of creation? Well, I'll come into a science group. It's very interesting. Very interesting. When I first come into a scientific group, a group of scientists that have invited me to speak, they will sit back real skeptically. What is this weirdo going to say? Attitude written all over their face. This creationist. And then I'll begin to show them some of the things that we're talking about here. And then they start to lean forward a little bit. I can tell they're getting interested. And then after our lecture goes into a little ways, there's a look of anger that comes across their face. Why haven't we heard these things before? We were at one large university in Washington State, very large university. And they invited us to come over for a series of meetings Sunday evening, Monday evening, Tuesday evening, and Wednesday evening on that campus. They had the largest auditorium available to us there on that campus. We came in Sunday night, Monday night, every single night the crowd grew until by Wednesday night we were way past the fire code limits for that building, but they still let us stay. And my wife, they didn't know who she was. She was at the back there kind of listening. Students were saying, how come we don't hear this in our classrooms? Even the professors by Wednesday night forgot who they were and acted like students and began to ask questions. It's just amazing. So there's tremendous ignorance out there. There's ignorance of what's in the pages of this book. I told Brother Van Duzeren, and this is a case, I have shown a picture of Newsweek magazine in public schools. On the cover of Newsweek magazine was the search for Adam and Eve, that article that came out several years ago. And I've had students raise their hands. Who are Adam and Eve? So there's a lot of ignorance out there. Thirdly, there's prejudice. All the news media and the stories, and we don't have a TV, but people tell us who watch TV. They say they put down Christians, they put down pastors, they put down churches, church people, they all be kind of weirdos and everything. So there's a lot of prejudice against this. And then there's intimidation. Our students, in addition to the fact that they feel like they're a round peg in a square hole, there's a lot of intimidation. A student, for example, when I was going through, and Brother Van Duzen and I were talking about this, how we were intimidated. That's when we were going through. It's worse now if we talk about geology, for example, and if I put a dot on there, if this circle represents all the knowledge of geology, everything that could be known, and if I were to put a little dot on there about how much I know about geology compared to what there is to know, I know that I don't know very much, especially as a student. And I know that I don't know very much about biology, and I know that I don't know very much about history compared to what there is to know. So the unbeliever comes along and says, well, look, all of geology proves you're wrong. All of biology proves you're wrong. You believe in a creator? You believe in a worldwide flood? Geology proves you're wrong? Biology proves you're wrong? You believe in history, that the Bible is real history? Oh, history goes back thousands and millions of years. How can you be so wrong? And we get intimidated. And I was very intimidated until, yes, I know that I don't know very much about geology. I know that I don't know very much about biology or history or any other subject compared to what there is to know. And I was intimidated when unbelievers made these claims until, how did I resist that? I resisted being intimidated when I found something out. Yes, if this represents all knowledge and I put a dot on there representing what I know that I don't know very much. But guess what? Nobody else does either. And when I found out that the doubter doesn't know any more, maybe not as much as I do, then I began to say it leveled the playing field. So number one, there isn't anyone on this earth smart enough to disagree with what the Creator tells us. People say, well, I'm an expert. The experts say, this is the expert on experts. So let me just share with you then some of the things that I began to learn after I found that out. I found out that Scripture gives me some advice. James 1:5 says, and this is what kind of got me started, James 1:5, when I was just getting, well, last year my graduate school, actually, Oregon State University. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraideth not. He won't get angry at you for asking. So I began to ask God for wisdom. Secondly, I have to learn to endure hardness. 2 Timothy 2:3 through 4. And the servant of the Lord, endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. So soldiers go through all kinds of hardships. So I had to learn how to do that too. Set a good example. 1 Timothy 4:12. Be an example of what the believers are. And you know, the non-Christian world out there, I'm going to tell you this, the non-Christian, they may be anti-Christian, just bad-mouthed and everything else, but they're hoping against hope that you won't crumble, because they're looking, this is their last hope. They look to Christianity. If anyone has any answers, it's Christianity. And they are really disappointed when we don't stand up. I was talking with a high school girl yesterday after we had a session over there at Lehigh Valley High School. We talked about some of the evidence for creation. And this girl was asking the question, one girl asked the question, well, if the earth is only 6,000 years old, then how can we see starlight millions of years away? You know, if stars are millions of light years away, how can we see the stars if the earth is only, and the universe is only 6,000 years old? Well, good question. And she didn't quite understand the answer. So she and another girl came up while we were eating lunch and stood at the door, and it finally dawned on me somebody was standing there, so I invited them to come on in. And this young woman was being pressured by a young man that she is friends with. This young man claims to be an agnostic and atheist, and he was pressuring her into immorality, basically, saying there's nothing wrong with it, that there aren't any absolutes. And this girl was quizzing me, and I said to her, I said, and she said that he'd made some kind of remark to her because she was standing firm on her commitment to be pure. And he'd made some kind of remark to her, just opened the door, just a crack, that he admired that. Just let that out a little bit. And I looked at this young woman and I said, the world will throw at you, they'll come at you like they just want to tear you apart. Like they're really angry at what's in the scriptures and stuff. And I said to that young woman, sometimes they'll do that. Often they will do that. More often than not. The reason they're doing that is everything else has let them down. This is their last hope. And they, if they're going to put their faith in what the scriptures tell us and who Jesus our Savior is, they don't want to be let down. So they're going to toss their worst stuff at it, hoping against hope that it won't crumble. Hoping that you won't buckle. And this girl just kind of came up and went out, resolved to stand firm on her faith. So set a good example, 1 Timothy 4:12. Be an example of the believers. Respect authority, 1 Timothy 6:1. We're asked to respect our authorities. That's tough to do. I was at one university last week, a university in our area. Very liberal. Very, very liberal. In fact, when I said to one of our Christian brothers, we're going to this university, he said, that university is very liberal. They're going to tear you up. Following that university, we went to a church to have a seminar, and I said, what's your relationship with this university? And they said, not very good. We are blackballed in this community. This church is blackballed in this community because one of the girls who went to this church in the biology class, thinking she was doing right, challenged the authority of the teacher and made herself so obnoxious all over the school campus, so obnoxious that nobody would even come to that church, even during the seminar. So she was not a good example. She didn't respect authority. There's a way to do it properly and not back down. Don't argue. Foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strifes. And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient, in meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil who are taken captive by him at his will. So don't argue with people. You know what? When you argue with people, you send the wrong signal. When we argue with a non-Christian thinking that'll make him come to Christ, you know what signal that sends? It sends a signal that it would be God's privilege for that unbeliever to believe in him. Is it God's privilege for us to believe in him? No. It's our privilege to believe in God, not his for us to believe in him. And then work hard. Work very, very hard. Colossians 3, 23 and 24. And whatsoever ye do, do it heartily, enthusiastically, unto the Lord, not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance where ye serve the Lord Christ. So that's biblical advice. Now, with that in background, if somebody comes up and asks us a question, like on this fossil, for example, if we're going to explain it to them, if we're going to explain it to them, or if we're going to train our young people to explain it, people on the outside, our answer has to be logical. They expect a logical answer. And number two, it has to agree with reality. So when we talk to people, we share with them the biblical picture of reality. Reality. You can invent all kinds of stories, but tie it down with reality. So what is our preparation strategy? What strategy do we use? Well, and this is very, very important. This is very important. Understand the issues, the alternatives. Learn how to think. And people today don't think anymore. I mean, sequential logic, they don't do that. Practice with some illustrations and then check the facts to make sure you have your facts right. Well, let's check out on the facts and look a little bit about that. Well, how do you learn how to think? We think in terms of presuppositions or bias or faith. Everybody has faith. So, and there are only two possible faiths. There are two and only two. The Bible is true. The Bible is not true. Can you think of a third? I've asked audience after audience, not only in North America, but in South America and in Asia and Europe. I've asked this question of all kinds of groups. And I've never had anyone suggest a third alternative. The Bible is true. The Bible is not true. Those are the two possibilities. And I was, of course, taught the idea that it wasn't true. That was my faith. I looked at the evidence and I tried to explain it by chance instead of creation, intelligent design. And instead of the fall and a flood, vast amounts of time. Vast amounts of time, the billions of years of time, were shoehorned in. It's a mythology that's out there as an alternative to the flood. The idea that the universe and the earth is very, very old is not from the facts. It's from a shoehorning in of a philosophical position. And then the cross is the evidence. So what are some facts? What are some of the areas that people look at? Well, the dinosaur puzzle. So here we have people asking all kinds of questions. I was at one Christian school, and the teacher said, oh, we don't believe in dinosaurs because we didn't learn about them in Sunday school, and they were invented by the evolutionists to shoot down our faith. Now here, and they were teaching students, and so the students were going out from this Christian school saying, oh, we don't believe in dinosaurs. I was invited by the Rotary Club of Portland, Oregon, a Rotary Club in Portland, Oregon, and they invited me to come in at noon hour to speak on creation. I was giving evidence for creation. After I finished, there was a man about as old as I am. He came up afterwards and said, sir, I have something against your side. I said, what is that? He said, my little granddaughter is very interested in dinosaurs. And she had a babysitter sitting from the church, local church, come in to babysit this little granddaughter. And so the little granddaughter asked the church gal, what about dinosaurs? And the church gal said, oh, we don't believe in dinosaurs because we didn't learn about them in Sunday school. And this man was very unhappy with the church and Christianity because of that kind of answer. And I had to say to him, sir, the Bible is the only one that gives satisfactory answers to dinosaurs. In fact, I have a whole lecture just on that topic. And we talked for a little while. He was so fascinated. Opened him back up again. Well, what about dinosaurs? How do we explain those? Well, dinosaurs were real creatures. Scientists have found skeletons of dinosaurs on every continent. We've found dinosaur skeletons in Antarctica. We found dinosaur skeletons up near the North Pole. And you'll notice when dinosaurs lived, they had a tropical climate. The entire Earth had a tropical climate like that. So dinosaurs were real. We found their evidences. They're not phony evidences. For example, there are many places all over the world, like down in Arizona or in Russia, or in Texas, or in Vermont. There are places where when that mud was soft, dinosaurs walked along and left their tracks. And that mud hardened into stone, like if you had a fresh cement sidewalk, left their tracks. You can go to see those. So that's one of the evidences. There are places, obviously, where we dig up other kinds of evidence, like this. This is caprolite. You know what caprolite is? Petrified dinosaur dung. And here is this caprolite, petrified dinosaur manure, been sitting in a stream. It's petrified, been sitting in a stream with water washing over it for a long time. And when I would pass it around to my class, my science class, they would look at this, and after they looked at it, they'd want to wash their hands. And I felt like I wanted to do it too. But it's dinosaur manure, petrified dinosaur manure. We have examples of that. We also have places where, like a dinosaur national monument, scientists dig out the bones of dinosaurs from the surrounding rock. You can see it. So dinosaurs were real creatures. They were very real creatures. In fact, there are even museums that you can go and see how scientists have worked very hard. Now, when we find the skeleton of a dinosaur, you don't usually find the entire skeleton, like this Tyrannosaurus rex. We may find only the skull, or some rib bones, or tail bones, or neck bones. We don't find the whole skeleton. Sometimes we do, but very rarely. So scientists work real hard to put those skeletons together into the shape that the animal had when it was alive, and you can go to museums and see that. For example, at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., you can see how scientists have worked real hard to put these things together. Or the Dinosaur National Monument, or Museum of the Rockies, or the relatively new museum up in Alberta, Canada, the Terrell Museum, down near Drumheller. And one of the fascinating features of this museum is they not only have the bones on display there at the Terrell Museum, but they also have in the back a diorama, a painting, what scientists think conditions were like when the dinosaurs lived there. So it's very, very fascinating. So a little bit of information now about dinosaurs. The word dinosaur was invented in 1841. That's very important. The word dinosaur was invented in 1841. Before 1841, if you'd gone back into an older, like, encyclopedia, like a scientific encyclopedia, like Van Nostrand's Science Encyclopedia, published before 1841, these same animals that we today call dinosaurs, before 1841, were known as dragons. So going to the older literature. Now, strictly speaking, the word dinosaur refers to a land animal. But there were reptiles that lived at the same time that flew in the air. There were reptiles that lived at the same time that were in the water. And I'm going to use the term in the loose sense, dinosaurs, to refer to the flying ones, the land ones, and the swimming ones all together in one section. Now, dinosaurs came in various sizes. There were dinosaurs that were way, way, way too large to fit inside this building. There were also adult dinosaurs that were no larger than a chicken. You could hold your own little adult pet dinosaur in your hand. How'd you like to do that? The average size, depending on how you do it numerically or size-wise, whatever, but the average size dinosaur, the average size dinosaur was about the size of a German Shepherd dog or a sheep. We're fascinated by the big ones, and rightly so, but the average size was about the size of a German Shepherd dog or a sheep. When scientists find the skeleton of a dinosaur like this Allosaurus, can we tell by looking at the skeleton what color eyes it had? Can you? No. Can you tell what color skin it had? No. By looking at the skeleton, scientists cannot tell what color the skin was, or even what the skin looked like in most cases, or what color eyes it had. So when you see an artist's representation of a dinosaur, that may well be close to the shape that the animal had. That may be close to the shape. But we don't know what the skin looked like or what color it was. In certain rare cases, enough of the dinosaur has been mummified so that the skin is there, or even some of the skin has been petrified. And one of the places you can see that is at the Terrell Museum. You can see the dinosaur skin there. Sort of reminds me, I suppose, of the skin on a big snake. And so I didn't reach over. I don't like snakes, so I didn't reach over and touch it. But that's sort of what it reminds me of. Now, these are some of the facts about dinosaurs. So you have to be sure of your facts if you're going to help people. These are some of the facts about dinosaurs. And facts, each scientific fact is like one piece of a jigsaw puzzle. Every scientific fact, the caprolite, the bone that we find, the footprints and so on, these facts are like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And what I wanted to do and what other people really want to do is to have you put all those pieces together for them into a picture that makes sense. Now, I'm going to ask you to do something today. and we ask people to do this, I'm going to ask you to think. Of all the world's religions, Christianity is a thinking man's religion. 1 Thessalonians 5:21 says, prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. Don't believe it just because I tell you. Don't believe it just because you see it in the newspaper or media or whatever, or maybe especially because you see it there. But you check it out. Check it out, see if it's really true. Now, think. How do we think? And this is what's been lost. This is how we think. And this is how everyone thinks. Even if they haven't practiced it, this is how God made our minds. This is the way logical systems work. So when you're talking with people, someone else may have a different position. How do you help them? How do you think with them to help them over the hurdles, getting them back to reality? I'm going to say this bluntly, and I'm prepared to document it because it's what we do in all the college campuses. We go to other groups as well. I don't say it in just these words, but I'll say it to you this way. Anyone, this book describes reality. And anyone who has an alternative explanation is out of touch with reality. Does not start here, but show them where they're out of touch with reality. And when they call uncle, then you show them reality. Now, you can do that at various times, most of the time, not the first session, but depending on how it works it around. So anybody's out of touch with Scripture is out of touch with reality. I care not in what area you talk about, because this book doesn't lie. So how do you help them do that? How do you help them think? Well, this diagram explains one of the major features of thinking. Everybody has the same exact evidence. Everybody has the same evidence. Everybody has the same evidence. But we have different ways of thinking about that evidence. If we start, for example, with our bias or presupposition, let's just call it A so we don't put an emotional attachment to it. If we start here with our thinking, if this is our faith, and we look at the evidence, then we'll come up with an explanation that agrees with that starting point. Somebody else could have a different starting point, different bias, different faith, look at the same evidence, come up with a different explanation. Now, the non-Christian does not deny that. Most of them don't realize it, but some of them do. For example, Dr. Chatterjee, who is very much an anti-Christian, anti-creationist, he's very much an evolutionist. And in the evolutionist propaganda magazine, Discover Magazine, Dr. Chatterjee was pointing out this exact point. So there's agreement on the other side. This is how things work. If you start with a different bias, you come up with a different explanation. And in Discover Magazine, they had an article, and he was pointing this out, and here's a photograph of it. He said, we all have the same evidence. Here are the actual bones that were found. These are the actual fossils that were found. One scientist looking at those fossils said, that's an animal. It was a feathered creature that lived in a tree. Another scientist looking at those same bones said, it lived in trees, but it didn't have feathers. Another scientist looking at that same bone said, it didn't live in trees. It didn't have feathers. It lived on the ground. It was a type of lizard. Another, no, it was a dinosaur. Same evidence, but different ways of thinking about that evidence. So we all have the same evidence. So as I began to look at this topic of dinosaurs, I realized that there were two ways, basically, to look at the evidence. And this is the view that I was taught. The Bible is not true, or the Bible is true. In the view that that I was taught, the Bible is not true, men and dinosaurs were separated by about 65 to 70 million years. Nobody saw a dinosaur in the view that the Bible isn't true. The last dinosaur died out about 65 to 70 million years before the first man came on Earth, according to that view. That's what I was taught. The other view, the Bible is true, men and dinosaurs lived together on Earth at the same time. One of Adam's favorite pets could have been a dinosaur. I mean, who wants to ride a horse when he can ride a dinosaur? And so here was one group of my friends that said, nobody ever saw a dinosaur. And another group of my science friends said, oh, no, men and dinosaurs lived together on Earth at the same time. One group of my friends said, men and dinosaurs lived together on Earth at the same time. Another group of my friends said, oh, no, nobody ever saw a dinosaur. Last one died out about 70 million years before man came on Earth. A 70 million year mistake? That's a bigger mistake than science normally makes. I mean, how was I going to resolve it? Well, what about this idea that I was taught that nobody ever saw a dinosaur? They weren't on here at Earth at the same time. By this time, I was thinking, that's an interesting story, but does it agree with reality? Nice story to say that nobody ever saw a dinosaur, but does it agree with reality? Well, what do we observe? We observe, for example, all over the world. In Europe, for example, they have cave paintings, and they are noted for the accuracy of their representations. They painted elk and buffalo and bear and dinosaurs. And the big puzzle has been, how could these people paint these animals, dinosaurs, so accurately when they didn't see them? Or even here in this country, for example, on the Supai Wall in the Grand Canyon, there are carvings that look like known types of dinosaurs. And the Supai Indians who are there now, they paint, but they do not carve. And they claim that they were here when their ancestors came. We have other things coming up all the time. You say, like what? Well, for example, in 1977, Japanese fishermen off New Zealand were bringing in their nets from a depth of nearly 900 feet. And in their nets was the carcass of an animal that had recently died. The Japanese fishermen brought it on board to untangle their nets, took photographs of it, took Japanese marine biologists who were on board the ship, took samples of that critter, took it back to Japan, and chemically analyzed it. Chemical analysis shows that this was not a mammal like a whale or a porpoise. Chemical analysis showed it wasn't a fish, it was reptilian. And the Japanese scientists said the only animal that fits with that description is a water-going dinosaur known as a plesiosaur. Well, what's happened since that time? All kinds of other research is coming to the front on that. Most recently is some research by Dr. LeBlanc and his colleagues up at the University of British Columbia in Canada. They've written a new book, Cadborosaurus, Survivor of the Deep. And there are marine reptiles that are classed as dinosaurs all over the world. For example, here in this book, and I have a copy of it, it's very fascinating, marine scientists find evidence of sea creature. And may I read you what the newspaper said? For centuries, Indians on Canada's west coast have reported sightings of a sea serpent similar to the Loch Ness Monster, speeding through Pacific Ocean waters. Now, two British Columbia scientists have pieced together what they believe is compelling evidence of the existence of the fabled long-necked creature known as Cadborosaurus. They say that in the past 60 years, at least six specimens of such a creature have been discovered, including a live baby one and a dead young one found undigested in the stomach of a whale, and they have photographs of that in the book. And I got the book. It's very, very fascinating. And just this last week, on Tuesday of this week, we're having a seminar, and one man came up after the seminar. He was raised in New York State. And he was very excited when I told him this story about this new book that's out and that they've found Cadborosaurus. They've seen the animals like that in Lake Chelan and in Lake Okanagan and Lake Champlain. He was raised in New York State in the Finger Lakes area, and he said he and his brother were out fishing one morning, and he saw a huge serpent, just the neck came up, huge serpent. And he was scared to death, this huge serpent right next to their boat. They were trying to get out of there as fast as they can, and then they suddenly realized that neck started attached to a large body. And this book documents that kind of evidence. Is there other evidence like that around as well, all over the world? For example, in inaccessible tropical regions, in Zaire as an illustration, People's Republic of the Congo, which is an impenetrable rainforest. There's no way to get in there except on foot. You can't take even a boat in because it's so bad. There have been reports for hundreds of years, downed aviators and missionaries. I have signed statements by missionaries that have seen this animal, which the natives refer to as the elephant lizard, Mukulivembe. And in 1980, Dr. Roy P. McCall, who's an evolutionist associated with the University of Chicago, he was president of the Cryptozoological Society. They had an expedition in there. And he wrote a book. My wife gave a copy of it for Christmas, A Living Dinosaur in Search of Mukulivembe. And it's a day-by-day travel account of them going in there to Lake Teeley and seeing these animals and traveling, tracing them on sonar and so on. They didn't capture one and bring it back and put it in the San Diego Zoo. More recently yet, Rory Nugent, 1993, had another expedition in there, Drums Along the Congo, On the Trail of Mukuli Bembe, The Last Living Dinosaur by Rory Nugent. Now, I don't recommend this book because it has so much profanity in it, but they also contacted the animal, saw pictures of it, and so on. The natives worship it. They wouldn't let them go out and get close to it. And it was real interesting. What was the evolutionist's excuse for finding this kind of evidence? I thought it was very interesting. What was the evolutionist's excuse? They said, this is the only place on Earth where conditions haven't changed for 70 million years, so we're not surprised that dinosaurs are still alive there. Well, when you come that bad, it's really too bad. So the plain fact is, evolutionism disagrees with the fossil record and the actual evidence that we're seeing today. More and more of this is coming up all the time. In fact, when we were in Australia, they have a magazine called Nexus Magazine, Great Birds of Fire. It appears not only are land dinosaurs most likely still alive and marine reptiles, but flying dinosaurs as well. The natives in Indonesia, for example, refer to these as grave robbers. You probably know that they bury their dead up, instead of under the ground, they bury them up. And at night, these flying creatures will come in. And some of them are pretty big, wingspans of up to 51 feet, will come in and take these. Down in Mexico, and we just saw a video of it here about 3 weeks ago, that these animals come in, and I'm sorry to be kind of blunt, but these animals will come in and attack the goats. They suck the blood and the intestines and stuff up through the neck out of these animals. And one of the native farmers down there set a coyote trap and caught one, and the Mexican government came in and took a video of it. I saw the video footage. It was all in Spanish. I didn't understand what was going on, but I could at least see the pictures of it. And here more recently, yet 2 years ago, and this was even on one of the Discovery channels, and I saw 4 or 5 minutes of video footage on it, they found a herd of mammoths in Nepal, still alive, about 100 animals still alive. And we saw one of them up close, about from here to that wall. He was in a stream. He reached down and picked up water and put it in his mouth and wash it out. And big, normal elephants, huge Indian elephants, don't even come up hardly to the shoulder on these mammoths, and they have the hump on them, so they're very much still alive. And if large animals like that can exist without us knowing about them until just 2 years ago, it's not surprising that some of these other large animals might still be around as well. So you want to check your facts out very thoroughly, and reality agrees that man and dinosaurs were together on Earth at the same time. So that's one of the areas that I wanted to check out very, very thoroughly. So we have two possibilities. The Bible is true, the Bible's not true. And if the Bible's true, we were created, we've fallen. We had a flood, and as an alternative to the flood, they introduced the idea of vast amounts of time. Well, what about that idea? What about dinosaurs? I had heard the view that men and dinosaurs weren't together on Earth at the same time. How does the Bible put it together? Well, let's just take a quickie look. I said, okay, I want to hear the Bible account. How does it explain it? The Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I was looking now for something that fit with reality, because I found out that the evolutionary model didn't agree. So what does the Bible say? In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And if you read in Genesis chapter 1, verse 20, it says that the marine creatures, water-going dinosaurs, were created on day 5 with the other marine creatures. Also on day 5 were the flying creatures. And scientists have dug up bones down in Texas of one of these flying pteranodons, and measuring from one wingtip to the other was more than 51 feet. That's bigger than most of our jet fighter planes. I've often thought if I'd been Adam, you know what I would have wanted to do? I would have wanted to put a saddle on one of those guys. Man, that'd be kind of fun, wouldn't it? Hey, guy, bank left. How about landing right there? Wouldn't that be kind of fun? That'd be really exciting, wouldn't it? And on day 6, the Genesis 1:24 says, God created the giant beast of the earth, what we would today call dinosaurs, the large land animals. And also on day 6, God created Adam and Eve. So the Bible and the word is tanin in Hebrew, which we would today translate dragon or dinosaur. Day 5 for water-going ones, 5 for flying ones, day 6 for land ones. And he created Adam and Eve. Now the Bible says, Adam named all the animals. That's a hint he probably wasn't too stupid. You find me a person that can name all the animals in Pennsylvania, let alone think up their names for the animals in the entire world. That's a hint he probably wasn't too stupid. And they sized up their characteristics, and based on their characteristics, gave it a name. And we like our names, don't we? You can tell the animals were eager to see what Adam was going to call them because they lined up. Wonder what he's going to call us. And you can tell he did a good job because they liked their names. They smiled. Oh, thank you, Adam. Thank you, Adam. That's a good name. Thank you. Oh, thank you, Adam. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Adam. That's a good name. And it was an absolutely beautiful paradise. Beautiful paradise. But it didn't stay that way. Because man, whom God had created, chose to accept a lie and depart from the truth. And we began a spiral downwards until finally it got so bad, as you know, the Bible tells us that there came a flood which killed everything that wasn't on the ark. Were dinosaurs on Noah's ark? If men and dinosaurs were together on here in the earth, then were dinosaurs on the ark? That's one of the common questions that comes up. And you'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't, how many Christian young people, when you ask them that question, they say no. I was at one Christian school, and I asked them, were dinosaurs on Noah's ark? Now, these students been raised in Christian homes. They'd gone to Christian schools, homes that believed the Bible, school that believed the Bible, churches that believed the Bible. And I asked them, were dinosaurs on Noah's ark? And they just yelled it out, no! And I looked at them. I tried to help them think. I asked them, what kind of animals did the Creator say to take onto the ark? They said, well, two of every sort, two of every type, two of every kind. So then I asked them, were dinosaurs a sort, type, and kind of animal? Uh-huh. So then I asked them again, were dinosaurs on Noah's ark? No. Not quite so loud this time, not so quite so definite, but still no. And it took several minutes of reasoning with these young people to get them to realize if the Creator said, take two of every sort, type, and kind of animal onto the ark, and dinosaurs a sort, type, and kind of animal, then dinosaurs were on Noah's ark. And as soon as they realized that dinosaurs were on Noah's ark, then they asked me a question. Adults usually phrase it differently. Adults usually say, how would they fit those big dinosaurs on Noah's ark? You know how children usually ask it? Try it sometime. Children usually say, wouldn't they sink the ark? We don't think, do we? We don't think. I looked at them. I said, how did dinosaurs start out their life? They said, oh, they hatched from eggs and then began to grow. And they're reptiles. Reptiles, as you probably know, they're not like other animals. If you have a kitten, it grows up and becomes a what? Cat. If you have a puppy, it grows up and becomes a dog. But reptiles aren't that way. Keep feeding a reptile, he'll just keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And scientists believe now that some of these big dinosaurs were not necessarily different kinds of dinosaurs. They were just the old great, 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 great granddaddies that had lived a long time. So I said to these young people, how did dinosaurs start out their life? And he said, oh, they started out as an egg and they began to grow. So I asked them, I said, why then go out and get the old great-great-great-granddaddies to be on the ark? Why not take small ones, young ones? I said, what's the purpose of being on the ark? They said, well, the purpose of being on the ark was to reproduce afterwards. So I asked them, which reproduces better, old great-great-great-granddaddies or young ones? We don't think, do we? So dinosaurs were a Noah's ark. In fact, when we went back to Dinosaur National Monument, we wanted to do some research. This is on the border between Utah and Colorado. There's a cliff there, and this is one of the best places, one of the best places, there are others as well, to find dinosaur skeletons. People park their cars, walk in at a second-story level, and at the second-story level, you can see workmen, visitors can see workmen chiseling out bones and so that scientists can put them together. After visitors see what they want, walk down here, there's a stairway down to a lower level, a little series of booths, miniature museums, as it were. First one says, what happened? What was it happened that killed all these dinosaurs? Next booth over says, dinosaurs, they're doomed. And the Park Service has an explanation. Maybe the dinosaurs couldn't find the kind of food they were used to eating, and so they starved to death. But that didn't fit the explanation for the swimming ones and the flying ones, so they had to X that one out. Maybe they couldn't adjust to the climate change. They had to X that one out. Every explanation they've ever thought out, they've had to X it out because it doesn't fit the facts. Did you know that right today there are over 50 theories as to what happened to the dinosaurs? Why over 50? Because none of them fit the facts. So I took this next picture out of a book on our national parks. Notice the second sentence, second paragraph down. It says, what killed these dinosaurs? And then they suggest, perhaps a blizzard of volcanic ash. Why do they suggest that? Because we see them buried in volcanic ash. Or a bacterial plague. Rivers washed their carcasses against a great sandbank where they were covered by sand and silt. They died in a watery situation. In plain language, it looks like they drowned. Now, when the dinosaurs died out, volcanoes were erupting, water, flying ones, land ones, swimming ones, they all died, and they died, it looks like, by drowning. What killed the dinosaurs? Well, could I hear it? The flood. You said, dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark. How could the flood have killed them? Yes, dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark. Before the flood, there were lots of dinosaurs. When the flood came, it wiped them all out, except those on the ark. After the flood, they got off the ark and never became established again in the great numbers that they were before the flood. And man was their worst enemy. If you were a prince and wanted some princess to marry you, you had to do a heroic deed. And so he went out and killed a what? Dragon. And man hunted these animals almost to extinction. They never became established again. And so after the flood, they were here, but they didn't get many numbers. When we had a dinosaur display in our area at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, the Portland, Oregonian newspaper had this world expert, extinct dinosaurs support living expert. And the Portland, Oregonian newspaper asked him this question, what happened to the dinosaurs? And here's his answer. Nobody knows for sure what happened to the dinosaurs, but whatever it was global and very fast. It happened all over the world. They all died at once, flying ones, land ones, swimming ones. They all died at once. So when I was down in California, they had this little article in the newspaper. Did giant wave drown the dinosaurs? Why do they say that? Because it looks like the dinosaurs died by drowning. So what's our latest theory? A big piece of rock, maybe 10 miles across, came down and splashed in the middle of the ocean and made a wave so high that that wave went around the whole world, and as it went by, the dinosaurs drowned. Yes. No, it's funny. And when you start telling big ones like that, you got to cover your tracks. So they've modified it a little bit now. They've had to modify it. This big rock, as it started down through the atmosphere, broke up into millions of little tiny rocks. And as it came down through the atmosphere, they got red hot. And all these little particles got red hot, and they ignited all of the world's forests on fire all at once and made so much smoke that the dinosaurs died by breathing smoke. So you see articles like this in the newspaper. Continent-sized firestorms linked to the demise of the dinosaurs. When it gets that bad, even the cartoonists cannot resist the temptation to poke fun. I'm not a particular fan of the Far Side cartoon, but I did get a chuckle out of this one. The real reason dinosaurs became extinct, too much cigarettes, too much smoke. Does the Bible mention dinosaurs? If you look up in a concordance or an index for the Bible, you will not find the word dinosaur. Why? The word dinosaur was invented when? 1841, and the Bible was written before 1841. But you will find a description of some very interesting animals. For example, in Job chapter 40. And you know, Job was written at the same time as Abraham, well after the Noah's flood. Job chapter 40, starting with verse 15. God says to Job, behold, in other words, look at, behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee. In other words, here was an animal that was alive when Job was, so he could go see him, look at him. Behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins. So here was an animal with big hips, and his force is in the navel of his belly. Big hips, a big stomach. Notice verse 18. His bones are like strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. Here was an animal that had bones so big they could only be compared to iron. Notice verse 17. He moveth his tail like a cedar tree. And you know what a cedar tree is like? They have a big base, and they're real tall, and they taper. What kind of an animal was Job supposed to look at? It's really amused me, the note in the margin of some Bibles. You look over there, it says behemoth. You look over there in the margin, it says hippopotamus. Have you ever seen the tail on a hippopotamus? Looks like a cedar tree, right? Well, skeptics come along and they say, how could this be talking about a real animal? You don't expect us to believe that, do you? They say, because look over at Job chapter 41, verses 18 through 21. You don't expect us to believe that, do you? What's it say? Let's read it. by his kneesings, that is his breathing in and out. By his kneesings a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. A fire-breathing dragon? Ha, ha, ha! Look how crazy the scriptures are. Oh, really? Maybe we should be a little bit more cautious about criticizing what our Creator says. Is it impossible to have a fire-breathing dragon? Well, let's just think about it. Think about it. Here was an animal with a big stomach, a large amount of plant material, biomass, large amount of plant material out of contact with air. Put a large amount of plant material out of contact with air, and it generates a gas called what? Methane gas, natural gas. Cows do the same thing. When a cow burps, it's methane gas. In fact, if you hold a match up in front of a cow and it burps, you have a nice flamethrower. I tell a story about one of my lectures after I mentioned this, and there was a fellow about as old as I am, came up afterwards, and he said, "I find what you say very interesting," because he said, "I was raised on a farm. And when I was 7 years old, I learned that cows burp methane gas. So one day when my daddy wasn't looking, I got a box of matches and I went up by the cow." And he said, "I lit a match," and he says, "I lit it by the cow." He says, "Nothing happened." Struck another match, nothing happened. He said, "I was almost out of matches and the cow burped." He says, "Scared the poor cow half to death." I find it very, very fascinating that scientists have found a type of dinosaur, a hadrosaur, and they have a set of tubes that come back up out of the skull down out the front. What could they have used those tubes for? Suppose they used it to vent that methane gas. You say, "Well, all right, how would they light it?" Well, any number of ways. Suppose they came down with those big teeth like the old flintlock rifle, that would ignite it. Or if we look at the animal, it had a really long neck. Suppose on that neck they had a series of electric organs like the electric eel or electric fish. They could have made a spark that would have done it. Or more likely, perhaps maybe because I'm a chemist, if the animal had a little phosphorus in its system or a little arsenic, and nearly all animals do, under those reducing conditions, arsenic goes to arsine gas, chemist formula AsH3, phosphorus goes to diphosphane gas, P2H4, and when those gases strike the air, they spontaneously ignite. That's why marsh gas lights. When Job wanted to roast marshmallows, he didn't need a match. "Hey, Dino, see those pile of sticks? Come here, boy." And there she goes. We would be foolish to criticize the Word of God. Absolutely foolish to criticize the Word of God. And so what I found out was, the idea that nobody ever saw a dinosaur did not fit with reality, but the Bible does. Well, what about these road strata that you see? They talk about, the unbelievers talk about, "Well, that took millions of years, and all these, this wasn't the result of a flood. Those are millions of years, and they have fossils in them," so they invented this idea of a geological column. You've seen it, haven't you? That 200 million years ago, for example, we had sea life. Millions of years later, dinosaurs, and then finally mammals, and on up to man. Well, That's a very nice story, I thought to myself. But does it agree with reality, this idea that the fossil layers are like that, one on top of the other? So that you have lower layers got simple life in them and the higher layers got more complicated life? I said to myself, that's a very nice story, but does it agree with reality? Well, you can find layers of the earth. They're real, aren't they? Do we have layers in the earth structure? Yes. Do they have fossils in them? Yes. Are sometimes simple fossils on the bottom and complicated fossils on top? Yes, but sometimes exactly the opposite. In fact, it's more often the opposite. Here are the Empire Mountains, for example. We see here's a light-colored layer of rock. There's a dark-colored layer of rock. According to evolutionism, which of those layers, the light one or the dark one, should have simple fossils in it compared to the other one? The light one should have simple fossils compared to the other. It's the exact opposite. The dark one has simple fossils. The light one as complicated fossils, exactly backwards. To make it worse, we have what are known as living fossils. This is what is known in science. These are what are known in science as living fossils, like the coelacanth. The coelacanth was supposed to be a link between fish and land animals, and they had this big thing coming out. They said was going to be evolving into a leg, and they didn't see. These things were not seen, according to the evolutionist dating scheme, in the fossil record for 65 million years. They weren't supposed to be around. In 1938, William Beebe, using a bathysphere, found them very much alive. And the natives down there have been knowing about them for years. And their skin is so rough, they dry it out and use it for sandpaper. And they're big. They're very much alive. Natives didn't know they weren't supposed to be finding them. How about the Solenodon? It hasn't been seen in the fossil record for 35 million years. Very much alive today. How about the Tuatara lizard? The Tuatara lizard hasn't been seen in the fossil record for 130 million years, and yet they're very much alive in New Zealand. How about the Lingula? It hasn't been seen in the fossil record for 500 million years. Very much alive. Here, for example, is a coelacanth. Very much alive. And they said this is where it's supposed to be evolving. Here's the Tuatara lizard. You can see those in New Zealand. Looks like a dinosaur, doesn't it? Very much alive. Hasn't been seen for millions of years in the fossil record. Living fossils. So as I check things out, and your young people need to know this, evolutionism is a myth. It's a story to get around the Bible, and it doesn't fit with reality in the fossil record or any other way. Doesn't agree. It just is totally against reality. So I came to the conclusion, if I don't want to get egg on my face, if I don't want to get embarrassed and always have to apologize for bad interpretations, then I'd better build my thinking in every area on the Scriptures. 2 Timothy 2:15, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. So if we have the truth, it's not because we're smarter than others, but because God in his grace and mercy has allowed us to see it. Well, I thank you for listening.